Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. In 2014, Molly Tierney gave a popular and provocative TEDx talk in Baltimore titled Rethinking Foster Care, which examined an unchecked loyalty to the idea of foster care and the flaws of intervention. As the director of Baltimore City's Department of Social Services, Molly manages the city's child welfare and public assistance programs, and she came to the city with some creative ideas in tow. After 7 years leading the agency, Molly left in February 2014 to join a New York-based management consulting firm. However, about 10 months later, she returned to the Department of Social Services, and we discussed what has changed since she came back. Molly was involved in a controversial program that allowed some teens in foster care to get a high school diploma from a Christian school in Philadelphia in a single day, which ended amid questioning from the Baltimore Sun in 2013. I talked to Molly about that decision, as well as her upbringing, unconventional thinking, and what she wishes she had had time to say in her TED Talk. Here's our conversation. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
Wow, that's a big opening question. Let's see.
It is. I should really stop. People tend to hate that one, so my apologies.
No, it's good. It's a luxurious question. A little about myself. I have a great life. I love living in Baltimore. I have a beautiful home, a fabulous family, an ever-growing daughter. And I get up every day, and I can't wait to go to work and do my job. So I'm a happy person with a good life.
Are you a Baltimore native?
No, I actually was born in D.C. and then spent my childhood in the Outer Banks and then spent maybe 20 years in Chicago, almost 20 years in Chicago before I came here.
What was a childhood in the Outer Banks like? Were you on the beach a lot?
Yes, it was good living. We lived on a little island. It was maybe, I think when I was a kid, it was maybe 800 families. It was very small. And, you know, the sort of place where you could leave after breakfast and be home by dinner. And there was plenty to do and no trouble to get into. And the village was totally raising you. Lots of outdoor time. Yes, lots of time on the beach. It was a fabulous, fabulous place to grow up. I'm grateful that my parents made that decision.
Why did they make that decision?
You know, after D.C. started to get sort of a little more hustle and bustle, and I think they felt like they wanted to raise their kids in an environment where their kids could leave in the morning and play all day and then come home for dinner.
So you knew, like, everyone in the town?
Oh, yeah, and everybody knew you. Anything you wanted to do beat you home before you
could get
there. Did
you like that? That sounds a little scary.
I didn't know the difference. That was just normal for me. And so it certainly has informed me as an adult. I sort of, even when I was living in Chicago, you know, that's a city of 4 million people, and I would get on the L train and look around presuming I was going to see somebody I knew. Because that's just the framework I had as a child, right? Everywhere you go, everybody knows you and you know everybody, so.
Have you had that experience in Baltimore at all? It can definitely feel like a small town to a lot of people.
Baltimore is a perfect fit for me. Chicago is a great place to be a young person, and you know, it's very vibrant and fabulous and lots to do. My temperament is a little happier, closer to the Mason-Dixon line. And I'll hope I never forget the first night I moved here. I was living down in Patterson Park, and I toddled up the street to a restaurant. It's not there anymore. It was called Three. Now it's called Bistro RX. But I toddled in there and sat up at the bar, and the guy that owned the place came over and introduced himself to me and asked my name, and he told me his name, and I was thinking, that's fine. Like, he's never going to remember me. I'm used to the Chicago living. I'm telling you, to this day, I ran into this guy, and he knows exactly who I am, exactly who I met. I think that is so Baltimore. I love that everywhere I go, I run into someone, and it's more than just a name that I know, but a context I have for them and a shared experience we have of living here.
So when you were a kid in the Outer Banks, besides playing outside and being out all day, what were you like, and did you know what you wanted to do later in life?
That's a great question. I feel like I always had the sense that I would be in service of some kind. Like I was sort of constantly volunteering or had the, I don't know, sort of concept of our role here on the planet is to serve others. And so I don't know that it took more shape than that for me, but I was always clear that's where I was headed and that's what I was doing. I don't know, I'd say as a kid I was pretty reticent, actually. Yeah, but, you know, like sort of had a handful of very close friends that I know to this day. And, yeah, I don't know how else to describe myself. I was a reasonably happy kid with a good life.
What kinds of causes did you care about and who did you volunteer for?
Well, we were very involved in church when I was growing up, so there was lots of volunteering around town that was going on. And then when I was an adolescent, I got happily tangled up with an organization in the Appalachian Mountains called the Appalachia Service Project, and I would spend summers there. That was sort of a housing rehab, community organizing, social justice organization that informed my work for the rest of my career, because I spent a lot of time there while I was working in West Virginia in the sort of bowels of coal country. And there's something, if you spend any length of time down there, there's a dynamic that kind of leaps off your surroundings at you that is, it's by definition of an extraction economy, right? So the people that own the thing that's valuable in West Virginia, which is coal, live out of state somewhere else. And they're taking the value of that money out of the state to somewhere else. And you can see the impact on sidewalks and schools and public services. And at least then, how hard it was on the people that were living in West Virginia. And so it sort of helped me learn stuff isn't doled out equitably in this country. And that needs some of our attention, how we could make this a more equitable place.
Was that surprising to you? And before that, would you describe your upbringing as sheltered at all, or how aware of the outside world were you?
I don't know that I think of myself as sheltered. I guess I think of myself as a child as generally aware. I guess I don't have anything to compare it to. You know, everyone thinks their own childhood is normal. Like, that's all. I didn't have anything to compare it to, and that was just sort of how life was.
Yeah, I guess I wonder if how much of a surprise that experience in West Virginia was, or was there any kind of wake-up call there?
I didn't think of it as a wake-up call, but I thought of it as very sad. Like, it hurt my heart so much to see how much there were people. You know, they had to send their kids a quarter of a mile down the mountain to get water in jugs that they were checking for leeches. And this was in the 80s. Like, it was those people, as to officially in the United States, they didn't exist. They didn't have birth certificates. They didn't have social security cards. They weren't paying a power bill. Like, they really were so remote and removed from the life as we knew it that there was something probably compelling to me about, like, I would go and have this experience working in West Virginia, and it really just was heart-wrenching to see the circumstances in which people were living. And then I would come home and people would say to me, did you have a good time? Thinking it was some kind of vacation or something like that. And I was like, wow, that's just an odd question. I learned a lot, and I see the world in a broader way, or I see the differences our country has. And probably to your point, that many people around me didn't have the opportunity to see that sort of thing, right?
What did you go to school for?
In college, to get a degree. Like, I have to go get this kind of degree. So I have a liberal arts degree. I went to Chapel Hill and got a degree in American Studies, which was great for me because I probably, as an adolescent, was a fairly irreverent person, you know, sort of rebel with any cause kind of thing. And American Studies was a great curriculum because, I don't know, if you study history at a liberal arts university, you're likely reading interpretations of things that happen in history by more modern people, like somebody would write a book about Abraham Lincoln or something like that. And in American Studies, then anyway, it only used primary sources. So if we were going to study the Constitution, we didn't read what anyone else thought about the Constitution, we read the Constitution. And that was a really good fit for me to really develop my own thinking or ways of thinking about the world. I found it interesting enough. I think I was one of those kids where if something wasn't interesting enough, I wouldn't have stuck with it. And if I hadn't stumbled by accident into an American Studies class, I bet I wouldn't have got a college degree. I bet I wouldn't have been able to stay and finish. But it held my attention and was a lot of fun. So, yeah, it was just a good old standard liberal arts, expand your mind degree.
Did you go immediately into social services after college?
The world was a different place back then. So the answer is yes. I left Chapel Hill and actually spent about 6 months just driving around the country. So I felt like I had studied about our country and thought, well, now I ought to go see it. And I'm very happy that I did that, right? So I bought a car and threw whatever I owned in the back seat and headed off with relatively no plan, just sort of, hey, I feel like turning left, or there's a little town you could check out. And I'm very glad that I did it alone, and I did it without, like, a dog, because my theory is it made people more likely to engage with me. There was no, you know what I'm saying? There was no additional thing they had to deal with. And I met the most fabulous people all across this country. Just like, it was a lovely, brilliant experience of what a rich network of communities we have. So I ended up out west for a while, and very briefly. West turned out not to be a very good fit for me. You know, in the South, you work a lot for the purpose of work, and then you have rest time, like lemonade on the porch, or you have a vacation, but your purpose is work. And in the West, the purpose is recreation, which makes perfect sense. Like everyone's skiing or snowboarding or doing something fabulous like that, and they work so that they can recreate, and it's the other way around in the South. It didn't make any sense to me, that sort of set of behaviors. It's also, I couldn't find it beautiful. Like I was living in Utah, which is a desert, and I was used to living in North Carolina, which is full of, you know, evergreens everywhere and lush. And so it ended up being very confusing for me, sort of psychically, I guess. So I took a fallback position and ended up in Chicago, where I got a job with a little not-for-profit case management agency. And back then, to get into case management, you needed a college degree of any kind and a car. And that was it. It's really different now. Like now our field believes you need to have studied social work in school or some kind of social science. So I don't know when that shift changed, maybe in the mid-90s, something like that, late 90s maybe. But it was a great opportunity for me. So I spent 7 years at that organization. It's a little shop called Kaleidoscope. It's a great place to learn about case management.
So if you just kind of like had this American studies degree and mm-hmm. were driving around the country and went to school to get a degree, like you said, like how did you know that it was case management that you were interested in, or kind of how did you fall into that work and what about it appealed to you?
Well, again, remember me, I'm the college student who's a rebel with any cause, and if it hadn't been very interesting for me, I wouldn't have stayed. The thing that held my attention in college was the opportunity to be with other people, and I knew about myself, well, that's what I like to do. I like to hang out with people. I like to learn about them and talk with them. And when I realized, okay, well, I was singing for my supper, literally. I was playing guitar at like restaurants and bars to make money. And I realized, well, that's not a lifestyle that's going to take me into any kind of substantial future. And started thinking about work. It's as simple as I had a bunch of buddies that I'd worked in West Virginia with who were working at this place in Chicago, who said, all right, come on back here. We can get you hooked up. You can get in this organization. And their probably calling card helped me feel more connected to, like, just having that relationship in place probably gave me the courage to do it. And then I was too young to differentiate among different kinds of social work. It was just, here's an opportunity to serve and a job that I think I could do.
Did it click with you immediately, and did you enjoy it?
I loved that job. It was great. We were working with families who were involved in the child welfare system, but who were either just on the brink of losing their kids to foster care or had just gotten their kids back from foster care. And our job as case managers was to figure out how we could keep that family safe, stable, and strong so that their kids never ended up in foster care. So I much prefer that end of the field, is how do we keep families together? And it's just a great opportunity to learn that, I don't know, like social services, it runs the risk always of starting from a place of what's wrong with you. Right, and I can fix it. I can fix you. And my experience with the kids I worked with and the parents I worked with was there's nothing wrong. They all had good reasons for what they were doing based on their experience of the world. They all had very, very good reasons for their behaviors. And the extent to which I could understand them, I could be more helpful as opposed to just saying, you shouldn't be doing that. So like, for instance, there were these awful occasions when children were separated from their parents. And back then, child welfare would get very worried about parents that got upset about that. Like some parents would get hysterical. I mean, falling out on the floor, full out, screaming, crying, hysterical, flailing. And we would say, you have to calm down. And I think, well, what reaction do we expect them to have? Because I'm actually more worried about the parent that doesn't react. It's a totally normal reaction. And to have our response be, you should stay calm, right? It's just like not honoring that folks have a reason for what they do. And I found that repeatedly over and over again with every person I worked with. Like, I hope I never forget, there was this one little kid. His name was Jesse. Oh, man, and he was a pup. He must have been 9 when I met him. And this is a kid, he only spoke in a whisper, and he wouldn't, like, it was very hard to draw him out. And he was bouncing around between a lot of different foster placements because someone had written in his file that he was a fire setter. And once you, at least back then, once you wrote that down in a kid's file, it was very hard to put or keep them anywhere because people only saw the liability and the challenge of that, right? And in a getting to know Jesse, I came to understand that the fire he was setting, the fire he had attempted to set, which he failed to do, he had attempted to set the bed in which his uncle was sleeping on fire, and he'd sort of lined matches all around his body and tried to light them. It's a I guess, a reasonably good effort for a 9-year-old. He was doing it on behalf of his 11-year-old sister who was being molested by this uncle. And I think, how does that make something wrong with Jesse? How does that not make him a hero of some kind? Right? And so I just felt like our field was misunderstanding people so much. And I think I would not have learned that had I not had the opportunity to work with all of those families.
Did that come to you quickly, or how steep was the learning curve when you took a position like that? Like, was that empathy and perspective, did you feel already ingrained in you, or did that take a lot of trial and error on your part?
I think it's just probably in me. It was in a less mature and informed way than it is now. Like, I've been doing it for 30 years now. But back then, I had a belief in people and a belief that anything was possible. Like, my favorite stuff was the stuff where people said, oh, that'll never work. And I was like, all right, well, now I'm going to have to go give that a try, because I think anything is possible. So I probably came in with a crude version of that. I'm trying to think, I wonder what part of the learning curve was steep for me. I wouldn't say, I mean, certainly I've learned an enormous amount from a lot of people. I don't mean to suggest that I came in there knowing all, because I certainly, by any stretch of the imagination, did not. But I think I did have a lot to learn about sort of what I felt was the established way of being and the establishment and the what felt to me like a very paternalistic is a better word, a very paternalistic way of treating families. And I had a lot of frustration in pushing against that, because I didn't like being treated that way, and I could see the impact it was having on the people I was working with.
So what brought you to Baltimore?
Good fortune, a crooked road and a lot of good fortune. So I spent, right, so 17 years in Chicago. So I was there in Kaleidoscope. I left there to go to graduate school and then worked for the State Child Welfare Agency for a bit. I'm a fellow with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. I did a little work in D.C. when Tony Williams was mayor there for their child welfare agency. Went back to Chicago and worked for Mayor Daley, which was a very powerful experience. He is a truly great public servant. And I was pitching in on the work he was doing. There were two big human service reform plans he had. One was the plan to transform public housing, which is when the country was sort of tearing down high-rises, as they did here in Baltimore, and doing more scattered site housing, and also a plan to end homelessness like we have here in Baltimore. And it was a very vibrant time, a lot of exciting things going on. And then in 2000, no, wait a second, let me think. It was 2005 or 2006. He turned his attention to trying to get the Olympics in Chicago, which is a laudable task and not my game, right? And so I just sort of felt like it wasn't as ripe a place for me anymore as a opportunity to really push the envelope in how we think about this field. And this job happened to be available. And I was ready to leave Chicago, but not brave enough to go somewhere where I didn't know anyone. And because I'd been a fellow here in Baltimore, I had knew a little bit of Baltimore, knew a handful of people here, so it felt like sort of a soft place to land and a great opportunity. It was a great professional opportunity for me.
And how did you find the adjustment to a much smaller city?
I don't remember that being hard. Again, much happier in a place where lots of folks know each other. And
well, I guess I also mean professionally, like going from working in Chicago to now being in a higher position of a smaller city. Like, I wonder if there's, if you can make more impact in that way, or if there was any kind of adjustment in that way.
Huh. I never thought about it. That's such an interesting question. Because you're right, they're wildly different. I think, you know, the way I was thinking about it at the time is, so imagine me, I've spent 20 years in a career working in environments, not-for-profit, state agencies, city agencies, that were approaching some version, because I'm inch wide and a mile deep. This is all I've ever done professionally, serving other people, right? And so I've been in all of these environments thinking, there's got to be another way to do this. I'm really believing there's another way. But I felt like I was sort of hitting my head against a glass ceiling, like I just couldn't break through to an opportunity with enough lateral for creativity that I could try some wildly different things. And so when I came here to Baltimore, part of the negotiation I had was really explicit. I'd like to try some really different ways of serving people. And if you're ready to do that, then great. But if you're not ready to do that, then don't move me all the way to Baltimore. Like, it's not going to be good for either of us. And the state of Maryland was very receptive to that. Again, it was a time when the agency I manage now was a hot mess and probably a job most people wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. But it turns out jobs like that, at least for me, a job like that is a surefire way to have a lot of lateral for creativity, right? Especially if one can say on the front end, it can't get worse, right? So let's try to do something different. And if if we can all manage through the change that's going to bring, then we might get to a different product in the end.
Well, you talked a lot about those creative ideas in a popular 2014 TEDx talk you gave here in Baltimore. For people who haven't seen it, I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about some of the concepts you discussed there.
Yeah, so what I was particularly talking about there and continuing to, you know, figure out my own thinking is the work of foster care in this country. And so foster care is, of course, or child welfare is, of course, the government response to keeping children safe. You know, so we think about how do we respond when we believe children have been abused or neglected. And sort of for institutional memory, the standard response has been separate them from their parents and put them in foster care. And I felt like over the course of my career, what I had concluded in 2014 is that the continued use of that intervention as the primary intervention is flying in the face of everything we know about what's happening to families. Right? Because I think families who lose their kids to foster care, I don't know if they ever heal from that. And that's people out in the community who are walking around unhealed, right? And that has consequences for communities everywhere. And the kids that come into foster care, and in particular, this was a time when our country believed at the first sign of trouble, bring a kid into foster care, and then once they're in, it's better to keep them in. And while they're in, it's better for them to live in group homes until they can behave well enough to earn a family. And I think, well, that feels to me not only antithetical to the needs of our species when we're young, but also the outcomes for kids whose that is the fate that befell them are abysmal. Like they have the worst outcomes of any kids in the country, and not through no fault of their own, right? They didn't come into foster care for anything they did, right? And so I really started thinking about what are the reasons this is occurring and what are alternatives that we could do. And we've been, you know, enormously successful in Baltimore City. We put a stick in the ground and said, what we're going to do is make sure every kid who's in Baltimore City, if they have to be in foster care, they're going to be with a family and they're going to get out of foster care as quickly as they can. And of course, it's going to be a last resort putting kids in foster care. We're going to do everything we can to keep them with their family. And as of today, we've reduced the number of kids in foster care in Baltimore City by 71% since we started in 2008. And I should be clear, we're not serving fewer people, right? We've just changed the intervention. What we're doing is working with trying to find families at an earlier point in whatever their struggle is so that we can bring support and interventions that would mean they and their children never have to suffer this fate of being separated. I am convinced this is the wave of the future of what we ought to be doing, particularly for the neighborhoods that are really struggling in Baltimore.
You talked about how foster care is this kind of like self-serving ecosystem. And so I'm wondering if these creative ideas, like how much pushback do you get? Are people defensive? And is it difficult to convince people of the efficacy of these ideas?
Well, you know, I do sort of think the proof is in the pudding. Like even people who might have disagreed with me along the way have stopped me to say, even though I disagreed with you, you know, like it's clear that this is better for kids. It was a big change for Baltimore and for Maryland because that was a time when what we were largely purchasing was the service of institution and group homes. And over about a 3 and 4 year period, we stopped making those purchases. And so that did impact a business model, right? Because again, that's what the state was buying. So that's what people opened. And now the state's buying something different. So there was something of a shift there. That was hard, I think. But we continued on the plot of, even though it's hard for some grown folks, and even if it's hard for some business owners, what we're going to do is what's best for kids. So I guess I don't mean to oversimplify this. I guess I would say there's an enormous amount of pushback. Pushback's maybe not the right word. There's enormous amount, as there always is, of discomfort and change. And I feel like it's not my intention to rattle people's cages. Never my intention to do that. But I also know that any time any of us is trying to change, like think of a habit you tried to change if you were trying to get to the gym or stop biting your nails or drink more water, I don't know. Like we all resist change, right? And so like if the example of we're trying to go to the gym every day, everybody says I'm going to go in the morning and then they wake up in the morning and then their brain, they start thinking about 6 reasons why they can't go and, you know, they don't want to pack the bag, like all of that stuff's happening. I think that's just human nature. And so the trick is, I think when one is trying to bring change to a entity this substantial, is how do you decipher between the kind of resistance that's actually a positive sign that people are changing, it's feedback that stuff is moving, and what do you need to see as, oh, there really is something about the change that's not a good fit for what's happening in Baltimore. And so we're sort of constantly jockeying that. How do we pivot whenever we think there's something that we're trying to do that's not working for either our staff or our community or the children and families we're serving, so that we can retrofit that into something that's more effective.
Earlier in your career, were you ever like more in line with the establishment, or how did you kind of like get to this point of having these, what some describe as more radical ideas?
I think it's safe to say I was never aligned with the establishment. If my dad were alive and if my mom were here, they would confirm that.
You also kind of talked about the psychology of this, like, quote, child saving, mm-hmm. and how, you know, the current system, it makes people feel good because they go in and they take the kid out of this family and they come in and save the day. And I guess I'm wondering how much does ego come into this? And is that ever something that you have to personally overcome in your work?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I think we all do, so that includes me as well. I try to make a constant study of releasing power. And I think my job, because I have authority, right, because of my title, I have it. I feel like the purpose of having power is to redistribute it. And so I'm constantly, how can I distribute authority for decision-making, authority for the movement of resources into people that don't have it now? Because I think there needs to be more minds at making those kinds of decisions. And I feel like that helps me. I also work very hard to build a leadership team where we have the ability to call the question to each other. Is that about you, or is that actually about the result we're trying to achieve? And so I'm grateful to them every day. You know, I think as to the larger field, you know, the trick about a TED Talk is you have 11 minutes. And when you're up on the stage, you can't see anything but a big clock right in front of you, and that clock's counting down. And the curators have been clear, if you go over time, we will kick you off the stage. And so to compress a career of ideas into 11 minutes is something of a challenge. If I'd had 12 and a half, I would have expanded some of that part of the conversation, because I didn't mean to convey that the people who are in this field aren't having impact, because I believe that they are. I think that I did when I was a case manager. I believe my case managers do. I believe professors of social work and clinicians and judges and lawyers, like, they're all having impact on the individual cases they're serving. I think the risk that we're on is that it's not having a net effect, right? If anyone is not sure that that's the case, they should drive over to the intersection of Pennsylvania and North Avenue. That zip code is 21217. 40% of the calls for child abuse and neglect that come to my agency every year come from that zip code alone. And if you just drive through it, like, it's a very challenged neighborhood. And we can't just sort of look at that and think, oh, what's happening in this neighborhood is about the privacy of what's happening in individual households. And if we just send a social worker into this household and a social worker or a clinician into that household, or to put that kid in foster care or get that person in a program, there's something greater at play. And I feel like the approach that we're having in child welfare that is send someone in to fix that family, everyone that's in the field deserves the benefit of being able to see the net effect of our work, and we're not at that yet. And I think that's because there's a flaw in our field, not because there's a flaw of anyone in the field.
You have been often praised for having out-of-the-box thinking, out-of-the-box ideas. One of the maybe out-of-the-box ideas that you were criticized for was the department spending $40,000 mm-hmm. to send kids to a private Christian high yep. school in Pennsylvania for one day to get a high school diploma. And some of our reporting found that some of those kids later went on to, you know, not successfully be able to get into community colleges, things like that. I mean, do you stand by that decision? And when do these out-of-the-box ideas fail?
Well, I take full responsibility for what happened with that, to be sure. You know, that was a situation in which the young people that went there. So there's the caseload in child welfare is not babies anymore, right? It's adolescents. So 60% of my caseload in foster care are people that are teenagers, and 40% of them are actually adults. They're 18 to 21, because you can be in foster care till you're 21 in Maryland. And the challenge that we have for the kids that are 18 to 21 is that many of them have been in foster care since they were little kids. And some of them have never lived with a family. And then all of a sudden, our field woke up when they were 18 or 19 and said, oh God, we have got to get you guys ready to be adults, as if that's a thing that we could do didactically, like by sending them into a classroom, as if that's a thing that was doable in 2 years' time, right? Because think about all that you learned, all that the average American learns, just by being in the presence of other people, right? Like, you learned about cleaning the house. You learned about cooking. You learned about, you know, you make rent before you go buy a pricey concert ticket. Like a billion things that you learned that you did not learn in a classroom. You just learned by being around people. That's not the experience of kids in foster care. So if they were living in a group home, when it was time to cook, they were told, get out of the kitchen. When it was time to clean, they were told, get out of the house, you're in the way. Right? And so the challenges they faced were enormous. Like they go, this pattern I used to see, they would go to buy shoes, and they would buy a pair of shoes that was too small for them because their logic was, well, the smaller number must mean they're cheaper. Right? When you and I learned about the Brannick device, that metal thing that you put your foot in so you get the right size shoe, and, you know, like, well, I did that once a year when I was a kid to go get my Buster Browns before school started. And that, like, those kids were not availed of that opportunity. And so they're staring down their 21st birthday, because once they turn 21, they're out of foster care and I cannot help them. They're staring down their 21st birthday like the barrel of a shotgun. And that window is closing every day for these young people. And when I arrived, the expectation that that the field had of my organization was that we would make sure they knew how to sign up for food stamps. Like, that was the level of expectation we had for these young people. And we did a lot of work of, no, this can't, like, people rise to the expectations we have of them. We have to help these young people imagine a very different life for themselves. And so we put together a very robust portfolio of programs and give these kids access to colleges and skilled training and world travel and all the kinds of things that young people should be doing. We're trying desperately to be good parents, which is very hard for government to do, right? Like, it's not our sweet spot, but we believe that no one else having stepped forward to parent these children, we're the last line of defense, and we're going to have to step forward and do something. And for most of the kids that we serve, this is reasonably successful, right? And if you looked at national statistics for kids aging out of foster care, the news is very bad. The outcomes that my team is achieving for older youth in foster care in Baltimore flies in the face of that data, right? Most of our kids are doing very well. There is a subset of them that I'm going to go with, their late bloomers, that I hope that there's going to be a time later in their life where they're going to decide to take the reins of their own lives and get moving. And this set of them, I worry a great deal about them. It's very difficult to get them to engage in anything. And even when some of my staff have said, well, let's put you in a car and let's drive around and see what it looks like to live in a homeless shelter and what it looks like to live under the Jones Falls, just because you understand, if you can't get with us to get a plan for going to school or getting a job or getting a skill training, that is what your life is going to look like, and we don't want that for you. Even then, these kids would say, I don't care. Like, they were just so burnt out on adults, they didn't believe anything we've said. We were not a population that was helpful to them over the course of their childhoods. And so this is a population we're talking about, a subset. And so there was a time when there was a set of these kids that found this school in Pennsylvania, and they came to me and said, not literally to me, but they came to the agency and said, hey, would you send us to this school? And these are kids that had never shown an interest in anything like this before. And we took a hard look at that school, and, you know, my team did their due diligence. And at the time, Pennsylvania listed this school as accredited on their website. Because that's how you check if you're going to send a kid to a school. You want to know, is it actually a school? Actually, right. According to the state of Pennsylvania's Department of Education, it was actually a school.
Yeah, it was accredited by an agency, but I think it turned out after Erica Green's reporting that it wasn't one of the three agencies that they sanctioned, right?
Well, our read of it was that it was an organization that was authorized by the State Department of Education in Pennsylvania to run this school and distribute diplomas, right? What the school had done, which you couldn't see from the research, this is my best understanding of it, is they had opened up this other program and put it under the umbrella without the state of Pennsylvania knowing about it, right? But so you could see from our research, it all looked like, okay, well, if that's what the state of Pennsylvania says. And we paused hard on that and thought, well, what is the wisdom of doing this? What is the wisdom of saying yes to these kids, will send you up there for when a real diploma is something that somebody scrapes and claws for? And finally came to, the kids were asking to do it. It was accredited on the state website. And it had the potential of giving these kids access to other things that as of then, they had no access to. Not to community colleges, not to jobs. Without a diploma, they could get nothing. And, you know, after Erica did that report, or when she was doing the report, we took a cold, hard look at it. And as I said to Erica then, the numbers are more or less, I think it was 80 or 81 kids we sent, and something like 85% of them came back with that diploma and actually got to community college or got a job. because they had that piece of paper. Now, it's perfectly correct that that program is not open and we're not sending kids to it anymore, but I just wouldn't want any of your listeners to think this is something that happened because we didn't care or we weren't being thoughtful or we weren't also scraping inclined to find anything that we could do to be helpful to these young people.
Did that spawn your decision to go into consulting briefly after that?
No, actually, it was totally unrelated. I know that The Sun reported it was related, but it was totally unrelated.
Oh, I didn't know if we had reported that.
Yes,
I was just asking
Erica
out of
reported
curiosity.
When I stepped away. No, I stepped away totally for personal reasons.
And what brought you back?
Some version of the same personal reasons. My spouse and I are adoptive parents, and we had adopted our little girl, and she was placed with us right after I left the agency, trying to remember the calendar in my mind. And consulting, of course, involves a lot of travel. And it turns out a little girl that's grown up in foster care needs mommy home every morning and every night. And so we just, you know, made a personal decision for the family. And then they had not appointed another director and welcomed me back into the fold. And it was just a perfect fit for me. I was happy to step back into role. It was good to get a little bit of a break, but I was happy to step back into role.
Yeah, did that time away, did that have any kind of effect on you coming back or the work that you do now?
Well, I think that, you know, my first stint at DSS in 2007 when I started, the place, it was such a rich and vibrant time of reform. And the then leadership team, it involved a lot of decision making by members of the executive team, myself and half a dozen other people. Like, we were deep in the weeds of the organization. And that was right for the time of reform. Reform takes a lot longer than I thought it was going to take. Like, I thought, oh yeah, we'll get reformed in 2 years. Nope, it took seven. But that's what it takes to change a place that's this big. And it was hard to break it of sort of needing the executive leadership involved in every decision. Right? And that's just, it's sort of an exhausting proposition. And I was glad that, as it turns out, stepping away for 10 months is the thing that did it. Because when I could come back, I could say, right, it's going to be different now. We're moving to a model of distributed authority. And we did it with this iteration of the leadership team with great intention, and it has been wildly successful. You know, because that's always the question in these jobs. How does one sustain oneself in any role in this field? Because it is, you know, there's a preposterous amount of work and pressure from all sides, and risks constantly. And, you know, stories I can't tell on this podcast because it would have your listeners racing to turn the radio off, right? And we, as a field, we get up every day and square our shoulders against the worst things that happen to children and family in this country and in this city. And that takes a toll on a person, like, you know, physically, spiritually, mentally. It takes a toll on our families, on our health, right? And so I think this phase two of Molly at DSS is a lot more focused on how do we all stay whole and healthy and intact while we're doing this important work.
I wanted to ask you about that toll and about how you are able to stay motivated and to continue doing this work.
Well, I'm still that young person that believes anything's possible. And among a group of people in leadership positions in Baltimore who always believe Baltimore's on the brink. We're on the brink of exploding into all the greatness and that we believe our city's capable of. And so that carries me a lot that I'm in the mix of that community. I prioritize my family and ask that all members of my team do, because I'm not sure how we could serve other people's families if we're not taking care of our own. And, you know, I have a good, strong meditative practice going. Like, there is a lot of work to find quiet spaces in my own brain that can help me not get overtaken by the sort of boundless grief that many people are facing in Baltimore.
Molly, thanks so much for speaking today.
I am so grateful to you for inviting me in.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Molly Tierney. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. Female Trouble is on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and everywhere else you listen to podcasts. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble and online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week.